Boker Tov, everybody. I'm Jay Kelman. I want to welcome you to the beginning of our new summer series. I hope you'll take a look. We have, I think, a wonderful schedule. Many of the classes will be starting up next week, some this week. We look forward to learning with you online, and please invite your friends to do so. And it's really a pleasure to welcome Dr. Dov Zakheim to kick off our series. I want to thank Mark Shapiro, Dr. Mark, who will be giving his class this evening at 8:30, who made the shidduch. And really, Dr. Zakheim has a very, very impressive resume. He was Under Secretary of Defense, Chief Financial Officer, Department of Defense. He worked in many government, high-level government. That's what his talk is about. But in addition to his many government positions, many work on charitable boards, he's a Talmud Chacham. I'm holding his book here on Nehemiah, Sefer Nehemiah, the Koran book. Of course, it would be most appropriate that someone who worked in high levels of government would write a book on Nehemiah. And it's really a pleasure to have him. And Dr. Zakheim, Bakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you. And this runs for an hour, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you for those of you who are tuning in. I want to dedicate this to the memory of my father, Zatzal, who today is his yahrzeit. And in many ways, I got interested in public service because he was a public servant. When he was a young man, still in Europe, he was the legal counsel of the Jewish community in Lithuania. And also actually was the secretary to Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, who at the time was the Gadol Ador. And so that was the example to me of sort of both serving your country and serving your God in inverse order, I should say. I really should start with a law that was initiated by Congressman Stephen Solars in the 1970s. He was a congressman from Brooklyn. He had actually gone to Yeshiva Flatbush. He's no longer with this world. He got a law passed that if you didn't work certain hours on a Friday and certainly on a Saturday in the government, you could make it up with what was called comp time. Now, what that did was open up federal government work to Orthodox Jews. You could also, all of a sudden, you could leave on Friday early. You didn't have to worry. You'd come in Sunday and you'd make it up, which in fact I did when I joined the Congressional Budget Office in 1975. I made it clear to the person who hired me that I didn't work on Saturdays. It wasn't a problem. I just would come in Sunday. Sometimes there were other people who came in on Sunday anyway. There were always workaholics. So I wasn't necessarily alone. While I was at the budget office, I was certainly not a very senior person in government, but everybody not only knew that I was Jewish, some people knew that I happened to have smicha. How it got out wasn't necessarily me. I don't call myself rabbi. But I recall one time I was in Denmark and I'm talking to a general there. I was in the military side of things and what was called the National Security Division of the Budget Office. And I mentioned to him that, you know, how wonderful it was that the Jews of Denmark had been saved in World War II. Remember, this is 75. It's not all that long after the war ended, 3 decades. When you're my age, 3 decades is nothing. And he basically poo-pooed it. It was like, so what's the big deal? As if to say, what else should we have done? I found that very, very interesting. And I found that in many ways, Scandinavians, leaving the Norwegians aside, because Quisling, that was a whole other problem, there were interesting stories that would come out of Scandinavia. And so I'll tell you one that'll, as they say, blow your mind. I had a friend, a young man, young diplomat from Finland named Rene Niebra. And he's still a friend. He is now Finland's leading expert on Russia. And since the Finns have fought the Russians and they're next door to the Russians, they understand the Russians probably better than anyone. Rene told me this unbelievable story. Marshal Mannerheim, who was the dictator of Finland, was allied to Nazi Germany, because the Finns had fought the Winter War with the Soviets, and anybody who hated the Soviets was their friend. Hitler asked Mannerheim to turn the Jews over. Mannerheim absolutely refused. Not only that, there were Jewish officers in the Finnish army who commanded Nazi troops. And there were Jewish doctors in the Finnish army who got the Nazi Iron Cross for saving Nazi soldiers. The world is truly a crazy place. And because, again, because people knew that I was Jewish and openly Jewish, I would hear these stories from people over and over again. When I went to the Pentagon in 1981, I had studied in England, and I repaid the British in spades, because when the Falkland Islands were invaded, I came into the office on Monday and told my boss, what are we doing about it? They were invaded on a Friday, and all Shabbos and all Sunday, that's all I heard about how terrible the Argentines were that they had invaded the Falkland Islands. And my boss said to me, why do you care? And I said, if you were home this weekend, and my boss was Jewish, I said, if you were home over Shabbos, you would have cared too. Well, working on the Falkland Islands, there was, of course, a question of what do I do on Shabbos? Wars don't stop on Shabbos. The only wartime activity I'm aware of that stopped on Shabbos is Josephus writes that in the Jewish War, that during the war against the Romans, if they could, the Jews would stop fighting on Saturday. Other than that, I wasn't aware of it. So the question was, what would I do? And the answer was, I gave them, in those days, we only had telephones, there was a signal. And if the phone rang a certain way, then I would pick it up. If it didn't ring a certain way, I didn't pick it up. And I was able to avoid going in Shabbos the entire time, even though, and Weinberger, Mrs. Thatcher, a number of people thanked me for it, even though I was in charge of supplying the Brits. Somehow I managed to avoid it, which is lesson number one. 99 times out of 100, I'll get to the 100th case, but 99 times out of 100, you really don't have to work on Shabbos. You can find a way. You can have a deputy. You can have signals in telephone calls or voicemails nowadays. You can, you know, if you're going somewhere, I've read of, people who call themselves Orthodox, flying on Shabbos, and they say, I have to. No, you don't have to. When I was undersecretary, if I needed to get somewhere, I flew Thursday night. I spent the extra day. If I had to pay for it myself, I paid for it myself. You don't have to do that. And I didn't do that during the Falklands. I got away with it. One other story during my days as in the Congressional Budget Office, I befriended someone who is now one of the leading journalists in France, leading analysts. His name is Michel Gorfinkel. He's a frum Jew. His wife covers her hair. And we were talking, and this is, again, going back many, many years, 40 years. She told me that she had grown up non-religious at all, to the point where they were so assimilated, her sister was baptized. And the only reason she wasn't baptized was because she was constantly having colds. So whenever the priest showed up, she had a cold. He couldn't put her in the font. Anyway, she says to me, I became frum because of the Minister of Interior of France. I just looked at her. Turned out in 1975, there was an explosion in front of the Reform Shul on the Rue Copernic in Paris. And the Minister of the Interior said, and now I'm translating for those of you who don't speak French, not only were Jews killed, but innocent people as well. And that caused Mais les innocents aussi. And that caused an uproar, and actually an international uproar. I remember reading about it in the States. And she, who had this vague notion that there was something Jewish about her, started looking into it. And to make a long story short, she told me, here I am where I am. So you never know. It might even be a minister who can make you frum. While I was in the Pentagon, and it was interesting too, my boss, who was Jewish, used to tell me he would give me a dispensation so I didn't have to leave early on Friday. I never had problems with the non-Jewish people. I had meetings. One time I had a meeting with the Deputy Secretary of Defense. In those days, I was exceedingly junior. He moved the meeting because of Shabbos. I don't know if this is other people's experience, but over time, I've always found that the biggest, you know, there's a pasuk, that, you know, essentially the troublemakers are Jews. And very often that becomes a problem, particularly if you're junior and you know, what are you going to say? And it makes you feel terribly awkward. I had another issue while I was in the Pentagon in those days. And that was, and this shows you how frustrating things can be. And again, where a Jew comes in. Rudolf Hess, the Nazi who had parachuted into England, was a prisoner in Spandau. And he, for years, he was in isolation. That was part of his life sentence, not to be able to talk to anybody. So in those days, I guess we still have them, but it's different now. In those days, a cable comes in from Embassy Bonn, because we weren't in Berlin in those days, that a soldier was fraternizing with Hess. So I went to my boss's boss at the time, and he wasn't Jewish, and he kind of poo-pooed it, but he said, look, go to the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Europe, who was Jewish. And he said, what's the big deal? Once that happened, what could I say? So again, you know, sometimes the problems emerge from within ourselves. The other, another time, I was at a meeting in Worcester in England, and I'm walking around the cathedral with this German named Carl Schnell. Now, I was in my 30s. Schnell was a good 15 years older than me, which meant he had been, a late teenager during the Nazi years. Again, he knew I was Jewish, and he says to me, you know, I stood up to the Nazis. I said, what did you do? He says, well, I was in the Hitler Air Corps, and my friends and I came to a meal without uniform. So my first reaction was, big deal. And then I thought to myself, you know what? Showing up in the academy without a uniform under the Nazis, that was pretty heroic. I've always had the attitude that they're innocent until proven guilty. You just don't know. There were some of them, there were Jews who survived in Berlin throughout the war. So, you know, we have a tendency to say, you know, all of them yimach shemam. The ones who should be yimach shemam are the ones who deserve it. And not everybody deserves it. Remember Rachav, who saved the Meraglim, the spies that Yahushua sent out, she wasn't Jewish either. And if you take the word literally, she was a lady of the night. And the Medrash turns around and says that she actually married Yahushua. So, you know, we have to be careful about these things. And it was kind of a lesson that I had learned. And finally, in my probably the most difficult time I had in the Pentagon was when I was asked to look into an Israeli airplane called the Levi. Now, the Israelis were using American money to build this plane. And the father of the plane was Moshe Ahrens, who had been defense minister at the time. He was minister without portfolio. And my father knew his father. Knew his father quite well, actually worked with his father. So it was an awkward moment. And I told my boss, part of my job was to be a fixer, like with the Falklands War, with other things. And so my boss asked me to look into this. Weinberger had his concerns about the plane. And my boss said, you know, what's going on? So I start looking into it and I discover that the Israelis were giving us old data, three-year-old data. Now, I happen to be a program analyst, by training, an economist and a program analyst. And I knew that that didn't fly. So I started looking into this, put together a team, worked very closely with Yitzhak Rabin on this, who had his doubts. The chief of staff of the Air Force, Bin Nun, Aviyu Bin Nun, also had doubts. And of course, the head of the Army had doubts, and the head of the Navy had doubts. And the reason was, there was concern that if that all the money that would go into this plane would essentially take away all the money from any other project Israel could come up with. Now, Ahrens was convinced that he could get more money out of the Congress. But that wasn't really the case at all. And in the meantime, other developments were being essentially held up. Everybody said, well, Weinberger was an anti-Semite, and that's why he hated the plane, that's why he hated Israel. But the Israelis were also, at the very same time, the Israeli Navy wanted to develop a new submarine that could fire missiles. And of course, if the money went to the plane, they wouldn't develop the submarine. The submarine's called the Dolphin. They still use it, and the missiles they fire are missiles that threaten Iran. The Lavi could never have threatened Iran. Weinberger said, okay. He said, look into that one too. And eventually he supported the program. But for me, the challenge was, here I was an Orthodox Jew. And sure enough, my family was harassed. My children in summer camp were told their father was a traitor. One person in shul in front of my small children said I should be carried out in a coffin. It was not a very pleasant time. At the end of the day, the Israeli cabinet voted to kill the plane. And the money went not only to buy, frankly, a much better plane, the F-16, but also supported the satellite program, the submarine program, the Merkava tank program, and basically allowed Israel to expand into the high-tech sector in a way they never could have done. But as an Orthodox Jew, let me tell you, I wouldn't wish this on other Orthodox Jews. When I left the Pentagon, I had a whole bunch of senior contacts, and those proved useful because one of the people I was working with as a consultant, and even at the time I was also a consultant to the Pentagon, turned out to be a man named Elmo Zumwalt. Bud Zumwalt, the former chief of naval operations, was very, very pro-Israel and very pro-Jewish. And I went into his office, because his office was two doors down from mine, and I said, you know, Bud, there's no Jewish chapel at the Naval Academy. So he called the superintendent of the Naval Academy, who happened to be somebody I knew as well, and I went to see him. And he also called the current, at the time, chief of naval operations, who also supported it. So the Navy was for it. The question was how to raise the money. I'm not a fundraiser. That's just not in my thing. Guy comes in to see me. And he says to me, I can raise the money. I've already raised money to support Jewish midshipmen at the academy. There's a Jewish midshipmen's club. I can raise the money for this chapel. So I said, wonderful. I'll do whatever I can to help you. He says to me, but there's one catch. I said, what's the catch? He said, my wife isn't Jewish. I said to him, look, you build that chapel and Jewish midshipmen and midship women, they're also called midshipmen, marry and identify as Jewish, your place in Gan Eden is there ahead of mine. The guy raised the money. And I would encourage anybody who visits Washington to make a side trip to Annapolis and see this chapel. It's part of the Navy's, one of the Navy's buildings. It's not a building on its own. It is, the Aron Kodesh is made of Jerusalem stone. It has a balcony so that if you want to have an Orthodox service, you can have an Orthodox service. It has a museum of Jews and naval history. It wasn't just Commodore Levy who was a leading Jew in the history of the Navy. It's a huge Kiddush Hashem. Not only that, there's a cupola in front of the chapel, and on the ceiling is glass shaped as a mug and dovet, so that anybody who flies over the United States Naval Academy will see a mug and dovet on the campus of the academy. That, I'm pretty proud of being behind that. Probably the most important thing I've done in my life. When I went back to the Pentagon under Don Rumsfeld, one of the things I noticed during the campaign, I was one of were called the Vulcans. It was a group of us. Condi Rice was our head. We had Paul Wolfowitz was there, who became Deputy Secretary of Defense. Bob Zelik, who wound up heading the World Bank. Steve Hadley, who wound up National Security Advisor. There was seven of us. And we met one time in Stanford, and Condi knew that I'd kept Shabbos, so everybody was at a hotel. She found me a place on campus. We also had some subcommittees, and one of them was headed by Don Rumsfeld. And we met in his house. It's not really a house. It was like a triplex apartment in Chicago, near the lake, Lakeshore Drive there. And I noticed that two floors below was a house with a big mezuzah on it. And I thought to myself, you know, not everybody who lives like Don Rumsfeld would want to live in a house where you see a mezuzah on one of the other doors. Rumsfeld was very, very good that way. Never had issues with Shabbos. In fact, when I was the first guy he hired. He gets announced and he comes into DC and he meets with me in the Four Seasons Hotel. And, he says to me, what would you like me to do? I could be undersecretary for the policy or the budget, the comptroller or technology, whatever. He said, I want you to be the budget guy because the budget is policy. I said, fine. And then I said, I'm not going to work on Saturday. He says, yeah, that's okay. So I felt guilty. And I said to him, Jewish law is if life is endangered on Saturday, of course I'll work. So he goes, well, it's the Pentagon. Life's always in danger on Saturday, every Saturday. I said to him, I'm not talking about nonsensical meetings. Well, of course, I didn't go in. I had a deputy. I used to send the deputy to the meetings that took place on Saturday till 9/11. 9/11, we're in a very different place. And for the first time in my life, I'm working on Friday night. I managed to avoid coming in on Shabbos, but once I was in the office on a Friday and papers were coming in and things that I had to sign, and I'd never signed anything on Shabbos in my life. It was an out-of-body experience, but I couldn't just walk away because if something got delayed or if my deputy wasn't senior enough to get something approved, and God forbid somebody got killed because they didn't get the right piece of equipment, I'd never get over it. My staff, none of whom was Jewish, used to tell me how horrible they felt because I always used to leave home for Shabbos, and now I wasn't leaving. And in fact, on Shemini Atzeres, remember, it was the first time I actually worked during the day. Now, undersecretaries of defense have a car and a driver. So the car picked me up, takes me to the Pentagon. Coming home, I realized I could make mincha. So the car took me to shul, to daven mincha. And I told the rabbi, this was my day of three firsts. I had never worked on a yontif before. I had never gone to shul before with a car. And I had never made mincha in time like I had that day. So being an undersecretary, you're quite senior. You're the third level. There's the secretary, there's this deputy secretary, and then there are a group of us who are undersecretaries. At the time, there were only four of us. Now there are six. There's great creep in the federal government like there is in academia. And so one of the things that Rumsfeld had me do, in addition to being in charge of the budget, was to be the coordinator of funding, international funding and international troop contributions, both to Afghanistan, where I was the civilian coordinator, and Iraq. Well, one time, the defense minister of Iraq comes to the Pentagon, and they had agreed that, of Poland, and they had agreed that Poland would send a brigade to Iraq. And Rumsfeld told the minister, Zakheim will work it out with you guys. So I go to Poland, and as it happened, my oldest son, Chaim, had some business in Warsaw at the same time. I started out in Krakow. No, I started out in Warsaw, actually. And then I had to go down to Krakow. He was still in Warsaw. While I was in Krakow, they took me to Auschwitz. But they didn't take me to Birkenau. Why Auschwitz? Because Auschwitz also has a lot of Polish dead. And the Poles have always made a big deal. It wasn't just the Jews who were killed. So they wanted me to see all of that. The other thing they would do is whenever I went, and wherever they gave me some, we went to a restaurant, whatever, where I had something to eat, if there was a piano, they would always play Sunrise, Sunset from Fiddler on the Roof. It was like, oh, he's a Jew. We have to play Sunrise, Sunset. In fact, when I left to go back to the States, the National Security Advisor, who turned out to be a quarter Jewish himself, gave me two things. He gave me a yad for laning, and he gave me a bottle of Fiddler vodka, which had a cap. When you opened it, it played Sunrise, Sunset. Mela, my son and I hooked up together, and because I also had to sign an agreement, I signed the agreement with the Poles, I had to sign another one with the Lithuanians. So we fly up together. Actually, it was on the plane of the president of Poland. He later was killed on that plane when it exploded. Thank God it didn't explode when I was on it. And we get to Vilna, and one of the things they want to show me is Panari Forest. So my son tagged along. I was in front of the line with the minister. He was the last guy there. I mean, he was the tag along. I don't know if any of you have been to Panari Forest. If you've been to Panari Forest, you'll see there's these big vats. And what the Nazis used to do is get all the Jews to stand on the edge of the vats, shoot them, and to get the next line of Jews to straighten all the dead Jews out and then shoot them. And there was a railway line. It was a railway line that there's nobody here to answer the phone, so I'm sorry, it's an interruption.
Call from Firestone,
Vilna. Ach, no, it's my brother-in-law. He can wait.
Call from Firestone, Vilna.
Reminds me one time I was speaking in front of several thousand people. And I got this, my cell phone went off, and I picked it up, and I said, oh, it's only Rumsfeld, and I put it down. Anyway, so there's this railway line, and what they used to do is they would take the Jews from the ghettos, put them on the cattle cars, and the railway would stop by the vats where they would herd the Jews off and go through the killings. Well, I heard a train coming, and my reaction was, they're bringing Jews. Afterwards, my son said to me, did you hear that train coming? I said, sure. He said, I felt like they were bringing Jews. There is something, I've been to the Latvian forest as well. There's blood in the ground there. There's blood in the trees. You feel it like, even worse almost than going to visit a concentration camp, because the trees are still there. The railway line is still there. The sky is still there. Everything is normal. And you know that this is what they did to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jews. It really got to me in a very big way. Another time when I was in Poland, I was a guest of the defense minister. And what they used to do, they had this fabulous guest house. I think it belonged to Graf Potocki, if you're familiar with the name Graf Potocki. A lot of Jewish stories about it. There's a whole family called Potocki, very wealthy counts. And they had mansions all over, two of them in Warsaw, mansions all over what was then Poland, including what's now Ukraine. Anyway, I had this house all to myself because I was the only guest. One time I had led a when I led the delegation to sign the agreement with the Poles, there were a whole bunch of us in the guest house, which made sense. It was a mansion, so everybody had a room to himself. I had this whole mansion to myself. First morning I'm there, this very tall Polish guy, I mean, out of central casting from Poland, a blonde crew cut, blue eyes like the sky, tall, thin, and he comes and brings me breakfast. And there's meat plates. And I'm looking at the meat, and I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, all right, I'm not going to eat this stuff. And he sees me staring at the meat, and he goes, it's glatt kosher, it's under ashkocha. You could have knocked me over with a feather. So being a senior person, you really have to think about what are the halachas? What can you do, what you cannot do? And Rabbi Kelman mentioned Nehemiah, because that started out as my model. You know, Nehemiah was the wine taster for the king. And the question was, how could he taste the wine for Artaxerxes? It was, you know, even if it wasn't Yayin Nesach used for religious purposes, it was still Stam Yenom. And the rabbis say that ordinary wine you're not supposed to drink. It's touched by a non-Jew. It's not like nowadays where, well, so many kosher wines are Yayin Mevushal, and you know, that's the way around it. If you cook it, it's okay. It wasn't cooked in those days. It didn't have the OU. And of course he was allowed to do this. And so the rabbi said in the Gemara that the reason he was allowed was because he was dealing with Malchus. In other words, he was a government official. And government officials, it turns out, and I did some research on this, and you can actually read the product of that, go to the website of the Institute of Jewish Ideas and Ideals. They produce a journal called Conversations, and some years ago, I wrote an article called, here's the title, Practicing Jews Serving in the National Security Community, Modalities and Challenges. We're dealing, of course, with the possibility of Pikuach Nefesh. And so the question becomes, how far up the chain do you have to be where you're a sufficiently senior decision maker that as a government official and as somebody whose decisions might affect literally life and death? And remember, I mean, one could argue that even if the entire military was non-Jewish, you would do it, Mishum Eva or Mishum Darkei Shalom, just to keep the peace. It doesn't matter. But as it happens, our military does have practicing Jews. We've actually had, most people don't know this, we've had generals that were senior to the most senior general in the Israeli army. The most senior general in the Israeli army is the chief of staff, what's called the Ramatkal. Chief of staff is a 3-star, a lieutenant general. We have had 2 Jewish 4-stars. We've had Bob Magnus, who was the assistant commandant of the Marine Corps. People don't normally associate Marines with Jews, but he was the number 2 of the Marine Corps, a 4-star general, a decorated pilot. And we also had Nordy Schwartz, who was the chief of staff of the United States Air Force. Chief of staff of the Israeli Air Force is a 2-star. Chief of Staff of the American Air Force is a 4-star, and he grew up in a conservative family, conservative household. I think he went to U.S. To Camp Ramah. He certainly was involved in USY, and he made it to the top of the Air Force. So we have Jews in the military. So Pikuach Nefesh is not just because we care about non-Jews. Pikuach Nefesh is because we actually have Jews there too, so that's kind of almost like an overlay to the importance of making sure that you are there to serve the military. So how far down can you go? my level, there wasn't a question. Assistant secretaries, which is the next level down, in many cases can make critical decisions. Very often they'll report directly to the Secretary of Defense, and sometimes even to the President. The next level down, and my second son already had this position, is Deputy Assistant Secretary. That's actually the highest level of the day-to-day work of the department and tends not to be a policy level, but sometimes that is too. So it becomes a function not just of the rank, it becomes a function of the responsibility. If your responsibility is such that a decision that you make could affect the lives of the military, maybe because you weren't there to support getting a weapon out in the field or some other reason, then Shabbos and Yontif just don't come in. And I can give you an example of that. You might think, well, the bureaucracy is so slow moving and it doesn't make a difference. One day in November of 01, a month or so after we had decided we were going to go after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, the Assistant Secretary for Research comes to see me. And he says, I've got a weapon system that's basically been sitting there for years. We think it's been developed, but the system, the bureaucracy simply doesn't bring it out into the field. And this weapon system, it's called a hyperbaric weapon. If you fire it into a cave, it catches the air and it'll blow everything out of the cave. And he needed, I don't know, 80 million or whatever it was, which when your budget is 450 billion, 80 million is a rounding error. So I said, look, when can you get this out there? He said, you get me the money, I can get it out there in a few months. So I got him the money and he got it out there in a few months. Now, every day, and by the way, it worked and it blew all these Al-Qaeda people hiding in caves, just it decimated them. Because it was a fireball and it went right through the caves. Well, if you delay by a day and the weapon is a day later and somebody dies the day before, well, that's the price of delay. So pikuach nefesh comes down to, do you have any kind of responsibility that might cause that delay? Or on the other hand, accelerate something that will allow people to live. You know, one of the great tragedies of any war is the last person to die in that war. And it happens. War of 1812, we fought the Battle of New Orleans. They'd actually made peace, but nobody knew that. So people were dying in the battle when peace had already been made. So clearly a decision, time is of the essence with these sorts of decisions. I might say something about anti-Semitism. The truth is, I never really encountered it. Maybe I've been fortunate. It came up in a veiled way once, when a general made a remark about pork. It's the only time that I served in the government that's the closest that ever came. Now, outside the government, different story. I've encountered it, as many other people have. But in the military, it just didn't happen. And I think one of the reasons, although, clearly there are anti-Semites in the military, there have been cases, especially troubles in the Air Force Academy, which is interesting because the current head of the Air Force, although he's a convert, he was born a Jew. His name's General Goldfein, and he does care about these things. But nevertheless, by and large, the military doesn't do that, and there's a very simple reason. You cannot fight on your own when you're in the military. You have to depend on other people. Whether you can be the biggest racist in the world, but you're going to have to depend on the black fellow who's a private right next to you and might save your life or might carry you from the field if you're wounded. And the same with Jews and the same with Muslims. It's the ultimate nowadays, the ultimate melting pot, because people have to look after each other. The Marines always say no Marine left behind. Well, who's going to be the one that picks you up so that you're not left behind? You don't know. So you don't take chances by venting whatever private hatreds you might have. And so I was very fortunate that way. By the way, the article that I wrote, which you could read, I've discovered, sometimes I've handed the article to people going into government. For instance, Elliot Cohen, Professor Elliot Cohen was Condi Rice's, for a while, counselor at the State Department, which is a very, very prominent job. I gave him that article. Interesting story about him. His son, who went to the Hebrew Academy here in Washington, Rafi, nice Jewish boy, always used to play with toy soldiers. He goes to Harvard and he joins, I don't know if he went to ROTC or officers training, but he joins the army. This nice Jewish kid finished first in Ranger class. He gets sent out to Iraq and he's put in charge of a unit that's supposed to disarm IEDs, improvised explosive devices, the things that were blowing up our people and our tanks and our armored vehicles. So you can imagine what it's like having to disarm those things. He had all kinds of experiences in Iraq. When his father, Elliot, was sworn in as counselor to the State Department, Rafi showed up in uniform, because he was still in the military, with his decorations and his yarmulke. There's something to be said. This country is going through tsuris now, like as bad as when I was a youngster in 68. But there's something about this country. And it's not every country that has chiefs of staff who are Jewish. It's not every country that has, today there was a obituary in the New York Times of Rabbi Lamb. It pointed out that, Joe Lieberman, Senator Lieberman, ran for vice president as an Orthodox Jew. Jack Lew was Secretary of the Treasury as an Orthodox Jew. In fact, Joe Lieberman made my life easy, because when I would travel to go out to the military, I would simply tell them, look, treat me the way you treat Senator Lieberman. Lieberman was a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And, when anybody in the Senate Armed Services Committee says jump, the Pentagon says, how high do you want me to go? So they all knew what Joe had, could do and couldn't do. And so I would say, just treat me like Senator Lieberman. Yes, Mr. Secretary. It was very, very easy. But the fact is that that's what this country's been about. That an Orthodox, it's not just that an Orthodox Jew can be part of society, can be the lawyer in a law firm or an accountant in a fancy accounting firm or whatever. It's that you can be a leader of this country, a leader of the military. That's very, very special. So I'm hoping, we should all hope, that the troubles that we're going through as I speak, whether it's economic, whether it's health-wise, whether it's the racial troubles we're having, that it'll pass. I mean, it actually, the riots have affected my family, because my son heads the Ronald Reagan Institute, and they just built a new building right near the White House, and the walls, most of which were made of glass, have been shattered, the doors have been shattered, the rioters have been rioting. So let's hope that it all passes. But the fact of the matter is that we have, not just at the highest levels, but at many levels, Orthodox Jews who are in the national security community, and who therefore are need to know what they can do and what they can't do. And it basically, the bottom line is, if it's a darabanan, it's a rabbinical ordinance. If that's the case, and you're dealing as a government official, and that's very, very key, not as a consultant, not as an advisor. You have to be the government official. You have to be what's called malchus. If you are, then you have all sorts of heterim. Torah laws are a different issue, but rabbinical laws are certainly the case. And I'll finish so that if somebody wants to ask me a question or two in the remaining few minutes, I'll finish with the fact that there's a gentleman in my community who is a senior, very firm guy, senior official in the department right now. And when he first went in, or when I saw him, I told him about my article. I gave him a copy. And a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to him. We were walking down the street, which is about all you can do right now. And we saw him, my wife and I, and we saw him and his wife walking. And he said to me, when I gave him the article, he figured he'd never need it. And now, with the virus and the urgency that the military has to face, as you know, we've had trouble on aircraft carriers. We're also using the military possibly to deal with the riots. I mean, there's a lot that the military is doing that it hasn't been doing and hasn't been really trained to do. And he said, you know, that article's coming in very handy. So let me stop there. We've got about 10 minutes, I think, Rabbi, and if anybody has some questions, I'll do my best to try to answer.
You can put them in the chat box, anybody. Thank
you. Yeah, I see one here. Did I give my article to Kushner? The answer is I didn't give it to him, but somebody else gave it to him. I gave it to somebody. I am not a Trump fan. I'm not going to go any further in politics. But when Kushner came in, I felt that it might be of use to him. And somebody I know who's was close to the Trump team, who wasn't Jewish, I said, please give this to Jared Kushner. Got a question. Where do I get my book? The Nehemiah book you can get on the Koren website. They're actually offering, Koren is, I have another book that's was about to be published, and then unfortunately the epidemic hit Israel, and it's put a stop to a lot of what Koren was doing. Because they're marketing their books as best they can, they're giving nice discounts, 10%, 20%, depends. So get on the Koren website, and you can get it there. There was somebody, Mark Shapiro, to everyone. Everyone says that Weinberger was an anti-Semite. You knew him very well. What do you say? Okay, let me look here. What do you say about this? He wasn't an anti-Semite. He had to deal with Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon's personality was such that he could make anybody an anti-Semite. He could make a Jew an anti-Semite. He was totally the opposite of Weinberger. In fact, Weinberger never got angry about anything, but he got angry at Ariel Sharon. Again, as I said, he not only let me go ahead and proceed with a whole modernization plan for the Israeli Navy, which was not only for their submarines, but also for their surface ships, which they use today. There was a time when it was the Israelis were and by the way, just as I put together a task force to evaluate the Levy with the best brains we had in the Air Force and in our Office of Program Evaluation, I put together a task force to look at the Israeli modernization program. We put out a report on that too. That task force included Israelis. It was a joint effort. I can't tell you everything about it because it's still a classified report. But Weinberger supported all that work. And he also, as I said, there was a time when the Israelis were thinking they might need something to be built in the United States or some systems to be built in the United States, Weinberger was all for it. And that, as I say, those submarines fire missiles that can hit Iran. The Levy couldn't have done that. So Weinberger wasn't bad that way. Another time, he was giving a speech to the American Jewish Committee, and he asked me to look the speech over. And I was really surprised at all the positive things he said. And apparently he was interrupted by applause a whole bunch of times. So I've been very, very cautious about labeling people anti-Semites. The only person I labeled an anti-Semite was somebody that George W. Bush also did. An interesting story, perhaps. When we were advising Bush, we used to go down to the governor's office in Austin. Well, one time we're coming out of the office, and I was the last one to come out with him, together with Rich Armitage, who later became Deputy Secretary of State and had also served as an Assistant Secretary in the Defense Department. Now, Armitage has adopted children of color. Very, very, very decent man. And he turns around, because this was at the time when Pat Buchanan was making a run for the nomination. He turns around to Bush, and he says to Bush, that Pat Buchanan is a goddamn SOB. And Bush, without missing a beat, said, and he's an anti-Semite too. It's the only person I've ever publicly called an anti-Semite. Brzezinski, for instance, has been called an anti-Semite. I knew Zbigniew Brzezinski very, very well. I met his wife. His son worked for me. When his other son was ambassador to Sweden, my wife and I stayed at his house. When I took Zbigniew's course at Columbia, I had my yarmulke on. He gave me a good grade anyway. He was very hurt that people called him an anti-Semite, because he wasn't. But he was Polish, and he wasn't super pro-Israel the way some people wanted. Bing, he's an anti-Semite. Not the case at all. Why did Weinberger have such a burn for Pollard? A Jewish guy in the Office of General Counsel named Manny Briskin told me one day that Pollard gave away a roomful of stuff. A roomful. As a result of the stuff he gave away, the Soviets were able to identify some of our people and put them away. How could that happen? Well, it turned out that the KGB had planted people even in the Prime Minister's office in Israel. And Pollard, by the way, offered his services first to South Africa before he offered them to Israel. So he made out that he was a Jewish martyr. He was no more Jewish martyr than O.J. Simpson was a black martyr. And in fact, if Pollard really cared so much about Israel, all he had to do was make Aliyah. One time I was interviewed on television in Israel, and I was told, Pollard is the good Jew, you're the bad Jew. What do you say to that? And I said, look, he had delusions about himself. Why did he go first to South Africa? Why did he take money from Israel so that he could have dinners in Paris with his wife? All he had to do was go on Aliyah. He could have joined the Israeli military. So I have no time for Pollard. And what do I say about Pollard in general? I think I just answered that. Let's see. The article, where do you get my book? I think that's it. Any other questions?
Thank you. Maybe if nobody has any questions, just ask, besides the Levy cases, did you ever face sort of a conflict between what you felt, you know, personally and as a Jew and American, not because of anti-Semitism, of course, but just because on a policy basis?
Well, I've never been conflicted. I remember one time I was asked by a reporter from Maariv, I think it was, how can you do this? I said, well, I'm an American first. Next day, the headline in Maariv said, Zakheim says he's an American first. I've never been conflicted. I'm an American. If I wanted to let me put it this way. I once heard Alan King, the comedian, say, Israel is my mother and America is my wife. You can love two women. And I think that's how I look at it. It's my spiritual homeland, but it's not where I live. It's not the country that I, that has, that frankly welcomed my parents. My mother was an immigrant from Ukraine, and as a little girl, very little girl, during the Russian Civil War. My father was an immigrant. If they hadn't met, I wouldn't even be here, because they came from different parts of the world. I think I'm an American. That's it. So I never felt conflicted. I did have another case when I was undersecretary, where, as I had mentioned, I was collecting equipment and signing up troops for our forces in Iraq. And the director general of the Israeli Ministry of Defense comes to my office with a list. And the list is of all these wonderful systems that Israel can provide us. I thought, that's fabulous. What a great thing to do. And I thanked him. And he says, and this is what they each cost. So I said to him, listen, I've already paid for this once, because they got it all with our foreign military assistance. Now you want me to pay a second time? I'm Michael, keep your systems. And I wouldn't take them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zak. I'm very interesting and really a you know, perspective from the inside. I want to thank you for taking your time and sharing with us. And I'm sure not everybody agrees with everything you said, but that's okay. You presented it very well and eloquently. And I want to thank you for all the service you do, both for, I live in Canada, so that's a whole different scenario. I'm, you know, for America and the West, the world, and of course for Israel, and your dedication both to America and the Jewish people. Thank you very much.
I actually negotiated an agreement with the Canadians.
Okay.
Several things, but I remember you folks may not know this, but we and the Canadians are very, very close, and we have actually a joint command in Colorado called NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command. And we had to, at the time, we had to modernize our, what had been called the DEW line, the early warning system. And so I told you I was a troubleshooter, so I was asked to reach an agreement with the Canadians, because it was a matter of how much Canada would spend. Everybody wanted us to spend all the money. I had to get the blood out of the Canadian stone.
Hasn't changed.
And I was told I had to do this by St. Patrick's Day, because President Reagan was going up to see the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Brian Mulroney, and he had to sign the agreement that day, so I already had a deadline. And we'd been working this for at least a year, maybe two, and nobody had gotten anywhere, so I was asked to fix it. Who do the Canadians send to deal with me? A nice Yiddel.
Herb Gray.
His father owned a Lubavitcher shop in Montreal, and they figured that way they could get me to give them what they wanted. And the answer was, look, you're a nice man, and I'm pleased that, you know, your father is a Meiches Farim, but that ain't going to change my position. Mela, we negotiated the agreement just before noon, because that was my deadline, and then the agreement was signed at noon.
Was it Herb Gray? Was that who it was?
No, it wasn't Herb Gray.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just.
By the way, there are a bunch of, again, in Canada as well, there have been, Jews have been senior in the defense world in many places. I dealt once with the French attaché, whose name was Cremieux, who was his great-great uncle had been the man who liberated the Jews of Algeria. The hero, one of the heroes of the Indian war against Pakistan in 1971 was General Jacob, who led the force that actually liberated Bangladesh. So, you know, we're not only a people that sit and never see the sun.
Okay, Dr. Shapiro, who really is responsible for this, so he has one last question. You can take a minute. Just are the Jewish chaplains in Iraq, do they wear Magen Davids on their uniforms?
Absolutely. Not only do Jewish chaplains wear, they don't wear Magen Davids. They wear a Saras Adibros, by the way. And not only that, they used to have Sdarim in Baghdad. It just wasn't an issue at all. And I remember one of the things that I saw when I was out there was we had a container of full of Jewish artifacts. And this had happened because Saddam Hussein had raided all the shuls, or got his interior ministry to raid all the shuls, and he stored everything they found in the basement of the interior ministry. A missile hit a water pipe, and everything got waterlogged. Well, the army rescued everything, put it in a massive container, and I looked through it. So some stuff was Sfarim that were quite old, but they had benchers from bar mitzvahs. I mean, all kinds of stuff. The man who arranged, I mean, I was involved with this, but the senior most person who arranged for this stuff to be brought to the United States, subsequently was cleaned up and became a traveling exhibit, was Vice President Cheney. He was the one that ultimately gave the order for the airlift of all this material. And as a postscript to all of this, the Iraqis keep wanting to get this stuff back. And it looked like time was up. It's been delayed, obviously, for many, many years, but looked like time was up. So it turns out a friend of mine happens to be the president of Iraq. And I got in touch with him, and it's still in the States.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Just this evening, Dr. Shapiro will be speaking. For those who were there last week, Mark mentioned that he can start this week with his correspondence with Dr. Norman Lamb. And as everybody knows, he passed away yesterday. Really a great, great person. Really one of the shapers and, you know, of our world. And I think Mark, he's dedicating the shiur tonight to him. He will talk about his personal correspondence with Dr. Lamb. And I think he'll speak a few minutes about his amazing contributions to Judaism and the Jewish people. So that's this evening, Wednesday morning. Nechama Price will be starting a series on leadership, the 12 of Am Yisrael, Bamidbar, the whole question of leadership, all the Shvatim. Wednesday evening, Naomi Seidman, who just wrote the book on Beis Yaakov and the Sarah Schneer movement, will be starting a 3-part series on Beis Yaakov and Poland. That should be very interesting. All should be interesting. We got more classes starting up next week. Please follow the emails. We look forward to seeing you. And Dr. Zakheim, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to Mark Shapiro for introducing us.
Right.
And a fellow congregant of Dov, I just wanted to say how good it is to hear him, and I look forward to the resumption of the Rabbis and Rulers talk at KMS as soon as safely available.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Kemp Mill and Toronto. So nice to join together again. I spent some time in Kemp Mill, had good friends who grew up when I was out in NYU, spent a few Shabbosim there. So I haven't been back in many years, but I know it's a very lovely area and a wonderful community in Kemp Mill, Maryland. Okay, everybody, we'll see you later. Please God, we'll see you during the week. Everybody be well, be healthy, and thank you very much. Bye-bye.